if you could give our listeners a brief bio of yourself.
Sure. I direct the Program on Global Security and Disarmament at the University of Maryland, which is a long-term program to look at the realities of international security after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Warsaw Pact, the traditional threats that drove U.S. defense policy during the Cold War. One of the ideas behind this program is looking at the connections all the way from guns and light weapons up to nuclear weapons and trying to see whether there are common obstacles and common opportunities to lessening the level of violence internationally, and, of course, as a result of that, trying to reduce the number of people who get killed through violent action. I come to this job with a background both in the non-governmental community and the university community. I have a PhD in political science with a specialization in defense and arms control. I earned that an increasingly long time ago from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston. It's now closer to 20 years than anything else, I guess. And I've also worked in the non-governmental community and nonprofit organizations for most of my career. I came back to the university in 1998 when I joined the University of Maryland to run this program.
Obviously, we're looking at the U.S. is currently at war with Iraq, and one of the major reasons given for that is Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. It seems obvious to me that he didn't just make those in his basement, that he got those weapons and components from somewhere. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. Saddam Hussein's military force has been cobbled together from a variety of different sources. In terms of his conventional weaponry, a lot of it comes from Russia and from France, two of the opponents of the present war. France is in an ironic situation. In the 1991 Gulf War, France wound up on the side of the U.S.-led coalition, and French pilots literally wound up flying against French aircraft that had been sold to Iraq. The irony of this was that at the time of the war, the Iraqis owed France some $5 billion for those weapons. Now, the United States has had a mixed role in this process. The fall of the Shah of Iran in 1979 had a dramatic influence on U.S. policy in the region. The United States had supported Iran and Saudi Arabia as the twin pillars of the Persian Gulf, in part as a means of trying to keep Iraq under control. And we had supplied both Saudi Arabia and Iran with some of the best weaponry that had ever been produced or sold around the world as a means of enforcing that policy. When the Shah of Iran fell, we then turned to a different kind of balancing act where we supported Iraq in the war against Iran. Secretly, I suspect many government officials were hoping that both sides would lose, and in many respects, both did. But we, at that time, provided Iraq with both precursor chemicals and biological materials that may well have been used in the chemical and biological weapons that we're worried about today. That said, the United States has not been Iraq's primary supplier for its programs of weapons of mass destruction. That really has come from elsewhere. We've contributed to the security environment in the region, which is unstable. We have armed most of the countries around Iraq at one time or another. We have switched allegiances on a relatively regular basis, and we've increased the risk that our soldiers will, in fact, wind up fighting our weapons as a result. I think it's a very unstable, very dangerous situation.
Then, has our weapons sales contributed to destabilizing that region?
I believe U.S. weapons policy has contributed significantly to destabilizing both the Persian Gulf and the Middle East region to the west. You really have the overlap between the Persian Gulf and the Middle East and exactly the area we're talking about, since Jordan, for example, borders both Israel and Iraq. What we've done for decades now is we've tried to provide weapons to countries in the theory that this would help them then take care of their self-defense needs without necessarily needing U.S. soldiers over there on a day-to-day basis. The United States started selling weapons abroad in the 1960s as a means of helping to produce a more positive cash flow for our foreign trade. and in that sense, weapons and toasters had a lot in common with one another. The real change took place in the early 1970s with the oil price shocks of 1973 and 1974, because you had countries such as Saudi Arabia and Iran with a strong desire for modern weaponry, and with the huge increases in oil prices, they were then able to afford what they wanted to buy. At the same time, you had the Nixon administration in 1968 exhibiting a desire to move away from situations where U.S. forces were going to be involved on a regular basis in conflicts around the globe. You also had the British decision to withdraw east of the Suez Canal at that time. And as we move toward the Nixon Doctrine, which was really the formal pronouncement of that policy, we then stepped up our military relationships with a lot of these countries. Now, countries like Iran and Saudi Arabia had an added advantage in that they could pay cash for the weapons that they were buying. This was something that made both contractors and our Defense Department very happy. It reduced the cost per unit, per airplane, for example, for our own forces, because these countries were helping to subsidize the research and development costs of developing new weapons. It helped keep the supply lines open at times when the demand might not have been as great for the U.S. forces. And it at least offered the promise of needing to send American troops abroad less often. Unfortunately, that hasn't been the result. What's happened instead is that we've had, if you look at the six neighbors of Iraq, Iran, Jordan, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey have all been major customers of the United States for its weapon systems. Syria is the only exception there. And four of those six, Jordan, Kuwait, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia, are still major customers of the United States. So this theory that this was going to provide for their self-defense and they wouldn't need to put our military forces at risk the same way simply hasn't proven out. Instead, what's happened is we've increased the risk that our weapons will be used against our forces because we're providing them to regimes that themselves are not extraordinarily stable. So we've helped contribute to the instability in the region. Our very presence in the region increases the instability there. And now we're having to put a quarter of a million of our soldiers and airmen at risk in trying to take over Iraq.
Aren't we also looking at, when they were promoting the concept of selling, I believe you call them current generation weapons,
yes,
to different countries in the region, in the short term that might reduce our costs, but isn't it in the long run forcing us to then develop next generation weapons that are extremely costly?
Well, yes, and each generation proves more expensive than last. That's one of those rules of military planning. In the short term, you can reduce the unit cost for these weapons. You can keep supply lines open. You can make the contractors happy. And in the long term, you make the contractors happy as well, because just as you said, what happens is you then produce pressure to develop and go into production on the next generation of weapons. We have been shortening that cycle consistently over the last couple of decades. It used to be that we were transferring, selling, or giving away F-4 and F-5 combat aircraft, and we were building the 14s, F-14s, 15s, 16s, the next generation. Now we're entering into agreements on our new fighters where we're actually agreeing to sell them as we're deploying them with American forces. That means that a particularly important military concept goes unfulfilled, and that concept is the idea of technological overmatch, that even if our weapons were to get into the wrong hands, our technology would be so superior to the adversaries that we would still be able to defeat those weapons. And the contractors, to a certain extent, have been fairly disingenuous about this. You see in the ads and in the materials they produce for Congress, that they'll talk about the number of countries that have current generation fighter aircraft, for example. And I'm talking about fighter aircraft, but virtually the identical discussion goes on with respect to tanks or missiles or armored combat vehicles and the like. And so they'll come up to Congress and they'll say, however many countries it is now, say 24, have advanced fighter aircraft. But they don't mention that most of those countries were actually supplied by us. It makes it look as though we've got adversaries out there who are doing this. And in reality, in a lot of the competitions of late, we've been engaged in what I call an arms race with ourselves. We've got the producers of the F-16 and the F-18 fighting against each other. Now, the French will usually come in with a bid as well, but often it seems as though it's really a question of the U.S. in essence fighting against itself for these contracts.
As an example, I believe, aren't we currently in a deal with the United Arab Emirates to sell them fighter aircraft that would actually be superior to ours?
Yes. One of the real questions these days is not simply the question of the airframe itself, but what you then hang on that frame. And what we've been agreeing to do lately is supplying more advanced missiles and more advanced avionics control systems for the aircraft, computer systems and the like, than are necessarily deployed with our own forces. We had an interesting situation in the Middle East a number of years ago where Israel actually turned down the advanced medium-range air-to-air missile because they felt that if they accepted it, then many of their neighbors were going to want them as well. And this was at a point at which their neighbors had much more impressive access to cash assets and would have been able to buy more of them than the Israelis could. They figured that the technological advance would be short-lived and would be extraordinarily costly in the long term.
Getting back to the proliferation of these weapons and the sale specifically of these weapons in the Middle East, my understanding is, let's say, sales to United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, that that's being driven more by the weapons producers than, let's say, by our State Department.
That has often been the case in recent years because we've been reaching the end of the normal life, quote-unquote, for some of these supply lines. And so the contractors, if they can make the sale abroad, can keep the supply lines open. So there's pressure there. In reality, though, if you look back over the last three decades, what you've generally had is, in fact, a sort of partnership between the State Department and the weapons producers. People in the State Department who serve on the country desks tend to think of those countries as their clients, and they want to serve them and give them what they want. Similarly, the weapons producers see the countries in very much the same way. But ironically, you see the objections to these sales frequently registered, you know, not from arms control groups alone, but from the Department of Defense, from the commanders who know that their guys are going to be fighting against these weapons if we provide them to unstable regimes. I'll use Iran as an example again, and it's just absolutely pivotal to what's going to happen in this region in the coming years. The Shah of Iran was described as looking at U.S. weapons catalogs as if they were the Sears catalog just before Christmas time. He loved the modern technology. He loved the idea that American weapons were better than anything else available around the world. And he bought a lot of weapons. And in particular, he bought advanced F-14 fighter aircraft. And the last time I checked, the Shah fell in 1979. So we're pushing 25 years at this point. The last time I checked, Iran still had operational F-14 fighter aircraft. Now, you wouldn't want to fly in them. I wouldn't want to fly in them. They had taken parts from other airplanes to keep them going because it was a very strong political statement to say that more than 20 years after the fall of the Shah, they could still fly American weapons. When we make these weapons transfer decisions, we are establishing relationships with these countries that are going to last for decades, and a lot of the recipients have gotten much smarter about how to handle those relationships. They play one contractor off against another. They demand excessive supplies of spare parts so that even if we try to cut them off, they can keep their weapons going. In cases where countries have dealt with the Russians, for example, they've had the Russians transfer whole supply lines. In other words, you transfer a manufacturing line so you could manufacture those, say, combat aircraft in a particular country like India, rather than simply saying they would buy completed MiGs or Sukhoi fighters. That was another way for countries to deal with the question of unreliability of supply. Now, normally, the supplier country and company wouldn't want to do that because there's a loss of control there. In the Russian case, they're sufficiently desperate for hard currency that they were willing to do that.
So I'm wondering if we can talk about what we, and I mean we as citizens, can do to rein in these absurd continuing sales. One of the things that is not being addressed in the media and really angers me is that on the one hand, we're prosecuting Saddam Hussein and actually the people of Iraq for these weapons of mass destruction, yet there were a significant number of U.S. corporations that contributed to building those weapons of mass destruction in the first place, and there's been no prosecution of those companies for those sales. Don't you think that's a bit hypocritical?
No, I don't think it's a bit hypocritical. I think it's very hypocritical. The Bush administration has played all sides of this argument. Bush administration officials were involved in the tilt toward Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war. Secretary Rumsfeld, Vice President Cheney were both involved in that process. And yet, if you ask about this, and I've tried to, the response I've gotten was, well, that was a completely different situation. We were trying to balance against the Ayatollah. Wouldn't you have wanted to do that? I said, wait a minute. These are the same guys who now stand up and do briefings and say, this man's been doing bad things for more than 20 years. Well, for the better part of half that time, we were on his side. And at some point, we do have to take responsibility for that. And now, some of the same companies, Halliburton, for example, are now signing up to help with the cleanup process and reconstruction after we presumably conquer Iraq. It reminds me of what happened at one point on the landmines campaign, where companies who had made tremendous profits selling landmines for years then turned around and said they were going to do landmine clearance. So as landmines became unpopular, they were going to establish themselves in a new industry of getting rid of the landmines. It's kind of like Halliburton saying, we're going to come help rebuild Iraq. And I think the compromise that a number of people reached was fairly simple and quite compelling, which was, okay, as long as you guys promise you're never going to make any more landmines, you close the plants, you stop production, then we'll talk with you about your being involved in the programs to get rid of them, the demining programs. But as long as you guys are producing mines, we don't think you should be able to be involved in what corporate terms, I guess, get described as upstream and downstream. It's not a bad precedent for this situation either.
And what's been the reaction with that so far?
People just say it's a totally different situation and you can't compare the two. But that's what you'd expect from the administration. These companies want to find ways they can profit everywhere along the line. That shouldn't be a surprise. And that's not just true of American companies. If the United States, in fact, conquers Iraq, and I do say the United States rather than the coalition, because it's really 90-95% our guys, if we do this, then the Russians and the French are going to want to be involved in the Iraqi oil industry. They're not going to just stand back and say, well, you know, you fought the war, so you deal with the proceeds. At the same time, we're going to be in a stunningly different situation than we were in 1991, where countries like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Japan really footed the bill for American forces. If you took out the fluff that was in the after-war budgets for things that I would argue simply didn't belong in there, you'd find that we may not have made a profit on the 91 war, but we sure broke even. We paid very little of those costs, even given the U.S. government figures. That's not going to be the case this time. Japan's not in that kind of situation to help. Neither is Kuwait. Neither is Saudi Arabia. Some of them are still hurting from the last time. So this reconstruction is also going to be largely on our plate, unless, of course, we can convince the international institutions like the United Nations to come forward and help with that. The irony of coming to the UN and saying, we made this mess, you clean it up, I think would not be lost on a lot of people.
So sticking with the U.S. corporations that contributed to Iraq's WMD program, I know that at one point the U.S. literally went to the U.N. and grabbed the 12,000-page document of Iraq's declaration of weapons to what appeared to be to excise about 6,000 to 8,000 pages of that. And recently Denis Kucinich has managed to pull that from their fingers and take it somewhere else. Do you know what the status of that is?
No, I don't.
Is there any recommendations you would have to citizens for following up on that so that we can find out what is on that other 6,000 to 8,000 pages?
I think the American people need to be much more involved in our entire foreign policy and national security policy formulation process. We have tended for too long to leave these issues to the military experts. And if we continue to do that, we will find U.S. forces not just in Iraq, but in Iran, North Korea, and who knows where else. Iraq is clearly seen as the first step in this process and by no means the last. But the American people are allowing this process to go on. If you look at public opinion for the war, it's gone up and down since the beginning of the war based on how well the campaigns were seemed to be going, but the overall support has increased since the beginning of the war. Now, do more people think we ought to be at a war with Iraq than did before the war started? I'm not sure. It tends to be a sort of proxy for people's support for the U.S. government. Pollsters found, for example, not long after the September 11th attacks, that if they asked people if they were doing better than they had been doing, you know, 6 months or a year before that, the vast majority of people said yes, they were. Demonstrably, the economy was not doing better, but it was seen as a way of showing loyalty, showing support for the United States. They didn't want to say they were doing worse, so they didn't. I'm afraid the same thing may be happening here. Instead, I believe what we need to be doing right now is saying Iraq is not Iran, is not North Korea, is not Syria, is not Libya, is not the Sudan. There are at least half a dozen countries in this world worthy of our serious attention and concern. But we're not going to be able to occupy them all. And the likelihood of our bringing democracy to any one of them, let alone all of them, is fairly low. And all we need to do to see some of the complexity of that objective is look at Afghanistan. We said we were going to do several things in Afghanistan. We were going to get the Taliban out of power. We largely succeeded with that, though some of them have simply changed their clothes and gone on to play different roles. We said that we were going to get Osama bin Laden, dead or alive. Don't think we've done that. We said we were going to bring democracy to Afghanistan. It's pretty clear we haven't done that either. President Karzai controls much of Kabul and not much else. We've got rival warlords in power in most of the rest of the country. Democracy is not evident. Yes, it's a long-term process, but this isn't what people bought into. People bought into getting, quote-unquote, Osama bin Laden, getting rid of al-Qaeda, getting Afghanistan back. We really haven't done any of those things. And anyone who believes that that's going to happen easily in Iraq, I think, is being excessively optimistic. Everything could go right. So far, it hasn't. So far, we've run into more opposition than the conservatives' description of the cakewalk would ever have suggested.
So how do you recommend to citizens to get more involved in these decisions?
People need to take the time to talk with each other, to talk to their public officials, to get informed on what's going on, to think about what the opportunities are for political and economic and diplomatic tools, not just military tools. There are a lot of good groups out there, groups like the Friends Committee on National Legislation, MoveOn.org, Peace Action, are all groups that have community-level involvement. And I don't know exactly who's active in the Seattle area, but I'd be surprised if you couldn't find at least one of those three that had active, at least community organizers in your area. Obviously, there's a great deal of information on the web as well. My organization's website is hosted at the University of Maryland, and it's www.bsos, for Behavioral and Social Sciences, .umd.edu, and then there's one of those little forward slashes, and then it's PGSD for Program on Global Security and Disarmament. If that's too complicated, you can just go to the University of Maryland website at umd.edu, and if you type in my name, Natalie Goldring, G-O-L-D-R-I-N-G, at the search engine, that will get you to one of our web pages. I'm glad to respond to emails. we have a very, very small staff, so phone calls are much more difficult for us to handle. But I'd also be able to suggest other sources of information. It's a tremendous amount of information out there. And I was just looking at one of the CBS web pages today, and they had a whole column of different organizations ranging from quite liberal to quite conservative with their contact information. The main thing, though, is people then have to be willing to speak out and talk about the fact that we don't always get to go last. We tend to assume that in our foreign policy and national security policy. In fact, other people have a voice, too. We saw this in the early days of the war where we kept saying that we just needed to do a little mopping up on the peninsula down in the southeastern part of Iraq around Mkhazar. We just needed to do a little mopping up. Well, we kept having to mop up because we had systematically underestimated the level of opposition that was there. I think too many people had bought into the Defense Department's vision of this war where the Iraqi people were going to come out, you know, waving their hands over their heads, delighted to see us. In fact, we've had people ambushed, military personnel ambushed, believing that was happening when people came out, pretended to be surrendering, and then turned guns on our forces. So we've been seduced by this idea that we're in control of the situation. Ultimately, we may be, but on a day-to-day basis, that's much less the case. And I think people need to speak out on that. You need to talk to your members of Congress. You also need to talk to your local legislators, because those are the people who are likely to be in positions of state and national leadership in the years to come, when we will most likely be talking about some of these same countries. There will no doubt be others added to the list that we're not even thinking of now. But if you think about Iran, Iraq, Syria, North Korea, Libya, Sudan, you've probably got a pretty good set of problem cases. And we needn't wait for the next war to find out where those countries are on a map.
All right. Well, Natalie Goldring, thank you for talking with us today.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I hope people will send me emails if they have questions or comments. This is a very complicated, very difficult time. This is not a time that features a lot of easy right answers, but there are some wrong ones. And I think one of those wrong answers is the idea that the U.S. can continue applying unilateral military force around the world without suffering consequences, both here at home and in the international community.